I'm James St. James. This is Night Fever, New York nightlife legends of the 70s, 80s, 90s, and beyond. I am joined, as always, by my co-hosts, the co-founders of World of Wonder, Fenton Bailey and Randy Barbato. Hello, chums.
Hello.
Hi.
Yay. You know, we say 70s, 80s, 90s, and beyond, but we really haven't gone beyond very much. And today, our guest is beyond the beyond. She is from the 20-teens, probably, is what I would say, right? Don't you think?
A little bit before.
A little bit before. She is a designer, an it girl, a party promoter. She is a survivor. We're going to talk about that. She is a healer, a public speaker, an artist, a muse, founder and curator of UniversalMother.love, which is a healing web that offers support, guidance, and knowledge. She is a curandera, which I have no idea what that is. What is that?
A curandera is a healer. It's an old school healer, pre-colonial healer.
Okay, okay. She is a fetishist. She might be a witch. I have no idea. So much more. There's so much more to her. I can't wait to dive into this. Welcome to the show, Dominique Echeverria.
Thank you.
I do want to just say very quickly, though, that this episode does come with a trigger warning. We will be discussing a suicide attempt that resulted in the loss of limbs. And ultimately, though, it is a story of healing and hope and of helping others. So I think you're going to want to stick around for this. How are you, my darling?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very good. You grew up in Los Angeles, right?
I grew up in San Francisco, Bay Area.
Bay Area. And you were in the San Francisco scene for a long time before you moved to New York.
Yes. I was a child of Juanita Moore and David Glamamore.
Old friends. Old friends. Glamamore from New York. Yeah.
Who has helped birth legend Funny Girl. I mean, hello. But Glamamore is iconic. Juanita Moore is iconic. And I started off as their children.
What was the club? And it was the drag scene, not the fetish scene.
It was the drag scene. And I was going to fashion school. And so as soon as all of them heard that I had a sewing machine, they're like, oh, you need practice? Well, I have some projects for you. And I was, you know, a teenager. I was 17 and going to Aunt Charlie's and the Tenderloin, going to the Stud, going to Gangway. Do you remember Gangway? Yes. Going to Deco. God bless Deco. Oof, Deco. I was a Tenderloin Mission child, and I ran around those parts.
So you were the go-to for all the drag queens when they needed outfits.
Drag queens, showgirls. There was a big new wave music scene that was happening. So there's a lot of live bands, a lot of glam rock bands. So literally everything.
And then you go to New York. What year did you go to New York?
I started going back and forth to New York around, I'd say, 2008. My lifeline there was actually Zanna Bain, leather designer Zanna Bain, and who's designed for Beyonce, Cardi B. Name a celebrity she's made stuff for. We started off as seeing sisters there. And then my friend Katie Storm, who she was a straight girl, and she kind of had an in with like the uptown daddies. And then a lot of my friends from San Francisco that were in the drag scene and the music scene and the burlesque scene were getting pushed out of San Francisco because like all the tech fees were taking over with Facebook and Instagram and everything. And so we all kind of fled. Some of us fled to Brooklyn. Some of us fled to Los Angeles. And beyond.
So what was the scene in New York like then? Because I think I'm right, James, you had left, right?
Oh, I was long gone, yes.
Yeah, so paint a picture for us of what the scene in New York was like then.
When I first stepped into New York, it was kind of dead. And a lot of the big promoters that are running New York now, they were having life changes. They were going through divorces and breakups and, you know, children were moving out of the house and clubs were shutting down and owners were changing. And so I went in at a time where it was like, to some, it, you know, it was like, oh, New York is like in this weird transition. And I saw it as an opportunity for so many possibilities. Like people were, I went at a very amazing time that I feel like not very many people have the opportunity to step into a time where someone's like, hey, what do you want to do? Oh, you're new in town? Like, come this way. I feel like most people have to like fight and like manipulate and compete. And I was very welcome.
Climb that social ladder. Yes.
Yeah. And I was kind of welcomed. It was like, oh, you have nightlife experience? Great. We're starting a new party. Oh, you make costumes and looks? Perfect. Show up.
You were also working with Suzanne Barsh a little bit at this point.
Yeah, in the very beginning. I was actually lucky because I had known a few of the promoters and a few of artists that were working with her. At the time, my friend Dylan Monroe, who has since passed.
Love Dylan. Gorgeous, gorgeous.
Everyone was like nervous to try new things. And I was very like, I got this. Put me in coach, you know, and like, let's have some fucking fun because I've had a hard ass life, honey. And I want to be on a dance floor with my friends.
And you become you're an it girl pretty quick off the bat, because like you said, you were a natural hostess. You were living with Ryan Burke, who is an amazing club kid makeup artist. I knew him in LA, and he went to New York and just took off, really just an amazing character. And you two were sort of the epicenter of what was happening during that time. I want to say, when I first met you, I was doing transformations, and I had gone to New York, and we were going to do 10 episodes. And I kept asking everybody who the new kids were, who the people I needed to get. And everyone kept saying, Ryan Burke and Dominique, Ryan and Dominique, Ryan and Dominique. And I had known Ryan, but I didn't know you. And so I started looking you up on Instagram and social media, and the looks that you were cooking up, that you were designing and wearing for yourself, it was very like... there was like Mexican religion. There was like a medieval and Roman, Greek goddess. There was like just all sorts of mythology thrown in there. It was very fascinating, very, very original and very over the top. And you came into the hotel room where we were filming, and I had no idea what to expect. You blew in like a tornado. It was just body, adi, adi, the booty, 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 the hair, the hair, the hair. And you were going 1,000 miles an hour. You had 10 people with you. We broke into the mini bar. I remember, thank you, Randy and Fenton, because I think we were just laughing and kicking, and immediately we caught on fire. We had the best time.
I was like, can I smoke weed in here? What's allowed?
it was a party at the Maritime.
So this is when you were working, right, James?
Yes, yes, yes. This is all okay, work.
He said no to all of this. He said no to me many times.
But yeah, I did. I was a very strict.
I don't even listen to my own mother, so.
But we did have a great time doing that episode, and I sort of was following you after that. I guess we should get into what started happening to you. Was there depression that set in? Was there what happened that led you to this doctor?
Not really, because like, and that was like one of the things. It was like I was modeling for all these different designers. I was living with my best friends. I was in a relationship. You know, I was hosting the biggest parties, like in some of the biggest parties in the world. You know, I was doing what I had always dreamt of doing. And living the life I'd always wanted to live, but I had always dealt with a lifelong of chronic illness, chronic pain, and PTSD, complex PTSD. Like from the moment I was born, I had health issues and back problems, and like I was constantly being put through the medical industrial complex with like kind of a blind eye and kind of thrown around carelessly. And people would always, like physicians would always be treating and trying to chase my symptoms, but no one was really like targeting the core issues. And like, you know, even when I was hosting parties, like I lived with Ryan later on, but I mean, the first few years I was hosting parties, I was actually a live-in nanny, having to start work at 7 a.m. after hosting a party till 4 a.m.
How were you managing the pain while you were doing all this?
I have always had this like crazy ability to transcend what my current experience is and almost like step into this other version of myself that can handle anything. That's lived experience. That's, you know, coming from rougher places and growing up with rougher people and, you know, being conditioned to just handle it, go to school anyways, like go to work anyways, because you don't have a choice. Right before the train accident, I had ruptured a disc in my spine. I had to rush to the emergency room and they had me there for 6 hours. And then you have to get a referral for an orthopedic doctor. Then they refer you for an MRI. And then they prescribe, you know, physical therapy or surgery, blah, blah, blah. And by the time you go through all of that, it's like a few weeks here, a month here, a few weeks there. So instead of me having any kind of care, they're just like, here's a bottle of 90 oxycodone. Here's a bottle of 100 sleeping pills. Oh, you have anxiety because you're having to work in pain? Here's some Seroquel. Oh, you got attacked at work and it triggered your PTSD? Here's some bipolar medication. All of that happened within a few months of each other. I don't know if you know this, but that 7-year anniversary of my accident is tomorrow.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That's why when I had my accident, I was like, I've had it with being sick and in pain. And none of you motherfuckers are helping me. All of you just keep calling me crazy and are ignoring my symptoms and here's some more pills. And so many queer people are just passed around the medical industrial complex so carelessly that like my spirit had no other choice but to dive balls deep into healing.
Well, you know, I think that's fascinating because just in my own life, someone I know is having some problems. And it is shocking the way the referral system, it's almost like no one will engage with the issue at hand. It's like, oh, well, we have to pass you off to this person for this, so you have to go find them. And add to that, there seems to be a general mental health crisis pandemic, so no one's available anyway. Like, there's an incredible shortage of qualified professionals who, even if they weren't going to do this refer pass to parcel sort of referral process, there's no one to. It's kind of a frightening situation.
It is. And I can tell you that during COVID, like, thank God I was training in all these different healing modalities, including long distance Reiki healing and, you know, curanderismo, all these different kinds of modalities. Because when the pandemic hit, I mean, I witnessed more friends and people in my community die from addiction, from misdiagnosis, from being neglected and then committing suicide because they kept saying, oh, here's a 3-month long wait to see a therapist, but we'll send you get the prescription started.
In a world full of straight people, aren't you glad there's WOW Presents Plus, the number one place in the world to see Drag Race? And so much more. Subscribe to WOW Presents Plus. Still only $4.99. Subscribe today as streamed on TV.
Start your engines and join me in the new mobile game, RuPaul's Drag Race Superstar. May the best superstar win. Available now.
There's this new thing where you can, all these telehealth people and all of these like online therapists, while yes, it is an answer, a lot of these psychiatrists, they'll, have an online session with you, a virtual session with you, like one or two times, send you a bottle of pills. And then like, it's up to the person to like show up to their Zoom session. And then a lot of these people will just keep taking the medication and they're not showing up to therapy. So they're not learning healthy coping skills. And, again, they're not taking care of like the emotion regulation and like the bigger issues. They're just trying to mask symptoms.
So let's go back to the weeks leading up to the suicide attempt. When did the suicidal ideations begin to happen? And when did you know that things were off?
When I hurt my spine and I was just getting passed around, I really felt like some of the most excruciating pain of my life. Calling my therapist, telling them what was going on. And their answer was like, let's double the dose. So I just didn't have the support that I needed. And I didn't know where to go. And I didn't even know where to start looking. And that's why I started Universal Mother, because it was like, whether you're having an emotional breakdown, whether you hurt your back, you can go to Universal Mother and there's someone or something that will lead you in the right direction instead of you having to wait sitting around praying to whatever God you believe in that someone will take pity on you in the system and fucking help you.
So this is how you described the events of that day in an interview that we did a few years ago.
That day I had a really triggering day and I walked to the train station. It was like, I felt like a robot.
So it was an intentional act.
Yes.
That you went there with that in mind.
Yeah.
It wasn't a spur of the moment, like I'm going to throw myself.
Well, I mean, it was spur of the moment at that moment. I hadn't been thinking about it all day or anything.
But you knew to go to the train station.
I walked straight to the train station. I sat on that chair like a zombie and I waited for the train to come and I threw myself in front of the train. I had my right arm ripped off. I had my right leg crushed and they had to surgically amputate it. I popped a lung, damaged my spleen and liver. I fractured my pelvis, my sacrum, my ribs, and parts of my spine.
Do you remember the going in front of the train? Do you remember that part?
Or this is a part that I hate answering.
I'm sorry.
No. Not for me, but for other people. Because I do remember everything.
I actually
woke up stuck on the train tracks. It didn't knock me out and I could feel everything. And I went in and out of consciousness even in the ambulance. And so I was very aware, felt and saw everything.
I can't imagine that pain.
The pain is so intense that you almost, like your body goes into shock. Your body does what it's supposed to do.
Well, the adrenaline kicks in and the body goes into shock and everything. Because you always hear about people sort of like leaving their body at that point.
I thought I was pushed down and drowning. And you know how like gross Subway will have like puddles of water? I thought I was drowning in a puddle of water, but I was choking on my blood.
So at what point were you told that your arm and your leg were gone?
My first memories were after a week or so. I had a suction vac sucking my arm and my leg, keeping it bloody and open. So it was very obvious that I had no arm and leg.
Not to be ghoulish here, but this is the one thing that makes me smile in this story is that the one thing that saved you.
My booty.
Your booty helped cushion.
Instead of the train hitting the back of my skull, killing me instantly, it hit my ass and it crushed my sacrum and the back of my pelvis instead. So me having strong ass muscles helps to have cushion. Otherwise, I would be having to sit on one of those donut rings all the time. My entire sacrum, like if anyone knows anything about chiropractic care, sits crushed. She's just crushed, honey. And my pelvis was crushed and no one set my bones. No one set me. So I healed completely crooked, out of place.
Oh. Do you remember those first few days afterwards?
I do. I remember the first few hours of being in the hospital.
Because I remember hearing about this on social media. Instantly, everyone was saying, you know, that talking about what had happened. And there was a few days there, a week or so, where it was touch or go. We didn't know.
I almost died. I died and had to get resuscitated by the paramedics. And actually, I never get emotional telling this story, but I only get emotional because one of the paramedics recently reached out to me. I tried to offer him so many things. I was like, he said he was a father. You know, I was like, let me get your son gifts. Let me send your money, your money. Let me bake your wife a pie, like anything. And he was just like happy that I was alive. And he was so nice. And like, the reason why I am well and I'm here is because I have continued to have so many people help me.
How long were you in the hospital for? At what point? Because I remember there was all sorts of...
I was bedridden for 2 months.
Okay. I do remember you were documenting later, you started documenting your healing process on Instagram. Yeah. And there was that, I get emotional just thinking about it because you're on the treadmill and it's your first step after you, I can't remember if you've been fitted for a prosthetic yet or if you were... with your crutches, but that first step and you were in so much pain and you were sobbing and the nurse was helping you, but you made it and you did that first step and there was just 100,000, just everybody was just, it was breathing a sigh of relief that this was, you were going to make it. This was the first step.
I hadn't even started walking yet. That was the first day I was cleared to stand on my pelvis. And I stood the first time because before my skeletal structure was cleared, when I was in the psych ward, I would lay in bed and I would do all these little exercises to keep my muscles strong, to keep my muscles from atrophy, because I was like ready to come back for revenge. So when my skeletal structure was cleared to stand, I stood the first time and my mom, she captured that moment. And to be honest, the reason why, because I didn't even want my phone or to be on social media, but my accident was like, you know, because everyone was trying to figure out what was going on or wanted to help me, you know, everyone was kind of talking about it before I ever could. And so one, I wanted to be clear what was going on, but also, I experienced a lot of traumatizing moments in the hospital and a lot of malpractice. And I was terrified that they were going to put me back in the psych ward because initially I went down there and I was locked in there against my will and held in isolation for 21 days.
Oh. And that's the last thing you need is to be isolated.
My wounds were neglected while I was down there. And they had to do a second surgery on my arm. And we tried to get lawyers and everything to get me out. And they just kept forcing medication on me. And kept me in isolation, and I was so terrified that I would be kept there forever. And everyone in my family was terrified that they were going to keep me there. And so I literally snuck in. I met nurses that were cool, and I snuck in phones, and I took photos and videos, and my mom helped me post them. And I just, like, and literally, like, a friend of mine, Henry de la Paz, I fucking love you. He was a hairdresser for someone that was, like, high up in the hospital's wife. And, like, him and someone else, like, communicated to my mom that they knew her. And, like, literally a combination of, like, literally the queer web got me out. Not a lawyer, not hospital staff, not a fucking therapist. The queer web of people knowing each other fucking helped me and got me out. And the queer web of my friends in media putting articles and out and everything kept me from them fucking keeping me locked in that fucking place and in the system as a fucking lifer, because that is what they do to people there.
Yeah. We talk about the first step. And yeah. then some of the consequential things afterwards mm-hmm. is you're getting better and you're feeling yeah. your mother is there helping you, right? Mm-hmm. And there were lots of
friends too. All your friends.
There were fundraisers. I remember a lot of different fundraisers at the clubs to get you money and to help pay for things that were happening.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that. It was I think there was like Battle Hem and Lady Fag helped a lot.
Lady Fag helped a lot. Suzanne Barsh helped a lot. They are mothers of the scene, and they definitely helped raise money. And like them, and then like I think there was like a GoFundMe and everything. So there was a combination of like $30,000 and. That was gone pretty much the first year because of, you know, hospital bills and therapy. And but I used that money to go to the best fucking therapist and psychiatrist. Chiropractic care, healing sessions, Reiki healing sessions, holistic medicine treatments. Holistic cleanses to flush all the medication they had me on out of my body.
Well, that's sort of a big deal right there, because at a certain point you realize that you can't rely on drugs anymore and you've got to flush your body of all the
yeah.
How do you stop doing pain pills when you've just had surgery and you've you know, you're in so much pain? How do you have the wherewithal to just quit the pain pills?
So it's a combination of lived experience, right? Having a history of like having to acclimate to pain and acclimate to illness. That took away the fear of trying, okay? And then when I started, I found the holistic methods extremely, if not more, effective. And I found a psychiatrist who specialized in helping people detox off of medication, not just psychiatric medication, but pain medication, because I felt like it was important to be monitored by a professional while I was trying out these holistic methods, right? To have someone help me practice discernment. And also, like, you know, so many people sometimes can get on this like healing wave that's like very narcissistic and like almost delusional if they don't go to the right healer or the right elder, you know. So I had a team of people really helping to monitor me and helping me test things out, and trusted me and listened to me as a patient. I said, hey, this was my negative experience and I need you guys to help me and listen to me, and I'm really scared and traumatized. And like, and I found an amazing chiropractor, Dr. Claire O'Neill, Glenfleet's Chiropractic Care, and she helped reset all of my bones. She was the only physician up until that point that had taken the time to explain what had happened to my body, what was rotated where, how my ruptured organs would affect different parts of me, what I needed to do, like how, like, you know, biodynamics, just like all the things. She's like, this is where your body is. This is where we're going to take it. And this is what we need to do to take it there. And I was just like, thank you. And she was so generous with like everything she was doing. She would tell me what she was doing, why she was doing it, how it would affect me. Just so patient, you know?
At a certain point, you made your foray back into the nightlife scene. And I remember seeing a picture of you, and you were dressed as a Greek statue. You were painted white and cracked, and you were a statue that had was missing an arm and a leg. And you and
like
Milo. Yeah, and I thought at that point, I thought she's going to be okay. She has a sense of humor about this. She's dressed as a broken statue, and everybody was going bananas seeing you.
Well, I mean, I had no choice. Like, literally, before I could even walk, my friends were like, oh my God. So are you getting a machine gun arm? Are we going to have swords, tentacles? What are we doing? Oh my God, I can't wait to paint you. Can I come? Like, before my wounds were even healed, my friends were like, can I come take pictures of your scars? Like...
You've got to love nightlife people for that. You have to, because to be able to make fun of it and to laugh at it and to want to turn it into art.
I've always been an artist, and I've always experienced suffering. So I'm like, well, I was inspired to transform myself into someone that was going to take on, like, and help restructure the communities around me the best that I can, the systems around me that are harming me. Like, I didn't just jump into that. Before I could walk, my father brought me to the Bates Two Spirit powwow, where I sat with a curandera named Alma, and she cleansed me and she gave me a soul retrieval healing. I had, like, you know, healers from my bloodline sit with me and help me cry and scream and wish and manifest and pray. And I experienced my first soul retrieval healing in February of 2016. So a month after I had left the hospital, just 1 month, I was still changing my bandages. And the curandera told me, she said, all indigenous nations and people are going to rise up and come together to change these colonial systems that are poisoning people, not just Native American people, but all people. These systems are poisoning all people, and you have to learn how to walk again. And you have to live, because we need you, because you are our relative, because you are one of our daughters. And so then I didn't just look at myself as my mother's daughter. I looked at myself as her daughter and the daughter of the healers that healed me, and my grandmother's daughter and my aunt's daughter, and all the mothers that have mothered me. The love that I have for my people is the biggest, most potent elixir that anyone can give me. You know, and her reawakening that in me and reminding me that, like, yes, these systems have made you sick, but these old ways and remembering who you are, and remembering the old ways of medicine that would heal our people before, these will make you well. And she gave me answers.
For people who might be listening, and I'm just saying, this is, you know, I'm so happy that you are on a different path now, and it's very inspiring. I do wonder for anyone who's listening who is at a experiencing a crisis moment, because yeah. when you describe that moment when you're at the train station and it was like you could take it no more, I just yeah. wonder what kind of advice you might be able to share to anyone who arrives at that crisis moment where they are ready to give up. What advice can you share?
Well, first, I will say absolutely this is the truth, that in the past 7 years, there are so many organizations, healers, therapy groups that have formed to hold space for people. So there is a whole new surge of helpers with answers and resources to help you when you need it. Number two, to stop and breathe and remember that this moment will pass. And I know people say that, but it's like, you aren't going to be suffering forever. If you're suffering right now, it is not going to be forever. There are, if it's physical pain, emotional pain, spiritual pain, isolation, transition, you lost your job, someone died, you know, there is a way to pull you out of that suffering and to help you navigate that suffering.
I guess we should probably say that there is a new national suicide hotline, 988, or you can text 741-741. The Trevor Project is a great for LGBTQIA youths at risk. They are 1-866-488-7386, or you can text 678-678. Where else would you suggest people go to?
So 7 years ago after my accident, I started a free healing resource website called universalmother.love. And on the community board page, there is a list of resources for mental health. There's hotlines. There's a link to the Trevor Project. There's lots of different links to different mental health services and grassroots organizations that help with counseling and trauma work. And on the healers page, there's about 19 different people that have experience with trauma counseling as well.
Nice. Fenton, do you have any questions or thoughts?
Well, no, it's such a powerful story that you tell, and I'm so sorry for all that you've been through, but I think the telling of it is painful, but also helpful to people. So thank you for doing that.
Yeah.
And the question I was wondering was like, you know, at what point did you decide to live? And you answered that very effectively. And I think naively, I was thinking, oh, well, it must have been right after, you know, you survived this terrible thing, and that then you would have decided to live. And it was just so interesting that you said, no, that wasn't the moment. It was later. And this very profound connection and realization that you made, that, you know, it's not by being your mother's daughter, but the daughter of these other people who need you around, you know.
Yeah.
So really, my question, James, is I don't have a question because Dominique is so eloquent and powerful.
There's this amazing YouTube video that I put on my wisdom page on this site, on the wisdom page. And it was talking about the evolution of queer people and like this amazing father who's like a biologist or scientist or something. He wanted to prove that his gay son was like super important to like evolution, like his existence is so important, and he wanted to prove it. And so he compared it to like bees and ants, and how like bees have like the ability to create the molecular structure needed to like have like a gatherer bee or like a pollinator bee or whatever, right? And then he started studying humans and like the Human Genome Project and stuff, which was a course over 10 years, and he saw that a lot of, you know, families with queer people, these souls that were born to the families as queer souls, like exist so that they can go off into the world learn new things, experience new things, evolve, grow, blossom, pollinate, change, explore different ideas, share, and then come back to the family and to the tribe or the community and help them learn and grow and see perspective. And so that in itself, like, you know, if you're gay, honey, like that alone should just let you know, like, you are, you know, you are, your existence is important.
I think that's really true, because I think so much of the dialogue has been about accepting queer people and being tolerated and gay rights, and none of it has really been about, well, what is the unique role of gay people? And I think we're beginning to recognize it. And I think that actually Randy and I talk about this a lot, and James too, is that pop culture is essentially queer culture.
And,
you know, it's made by the gays.
Yeah.
And that's not to say, that's not therefore to say that we're very important, but that we perform, we have a critical role to play in the life of humanity, you know, that, and I think that I want to see that video, because I think that that's, there was another article I read about how the idea that often the gay kid in the family will be the one that actually keeps the family together, you know, and that while everybody's busy being heterosexual and slaughtering each other and abusing each other and just getting theirs, that the gay person ends up being the diplomat or the peacemaker or the unifier, you know, sort of.
He talks about that.
Dominique, do you experience a lot of pain now? I mean, how is it?
I stick to a really strict schedule of physical therapy, chiropractic care, dance class, yoga, Reiki healing.
I do know that you had just recently said that you were looking for a wheelchair accessible apartment.
Yes, it has been so fucking hard to find a place that is wheelchair accessible. Like, I love where I am right now, but it has stairs. And so it's like, for the past 2 years, like, everywhere I end up living, like, isn't wheelchair accessible. So I haven't been able to take a day off of my leg in 2 years.
I do have one very quick question. In your intro, James, you mentioned that you were a fetishist, and I have a fetish. My fetish is other people's fetishes. So I just, you know, very quickly, what's your fetishist?
I love being adored. I love being a show pony. I love being like, you know, I want to seduce the entire room. That's my fetish.
You are very much in the leather scene here in Los Angeles, and you counsel a lot of the fetish kids.
Yes, a lot of my healing clients are sex workers, people in the BDSM community, you know, lawyers, caseworkers, doctors, moms, you know, rent boys, you know, it's a wide range. And, you know, healing is not linear, and it doesn't just belong to one person. It's like we live in an overstimulated society that's like constantly traumatizing us in different ways. And so, you know, it's important to, you know, reprogram your brain in ways that help you and learn coping skills.
Okay. Well, and on that note, I think we're going to wrap it up there. Thank you so much, Dominique. I love you so much.
You know, I just want to say I am so glad that you're here. This has been an edition of Night Fever, unlike any other, I would have to say.
Wait, should we see my body? Because you were talking about my body.
Yes, yes, please. Okay. Let's see. Okay. Oh, there's the booty. There's the booty. Okay.
The booty that saves, yes. Oh my God.
Ouch. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, all right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I love you very much, and I will talk to you very soon. I miss you.
Yeah.